The lecture that I'm going to give this evening that I've given some other places is a lecture I thought I'd never have to give among Christian and particularly Reformed Christian groups. And the subject is, should Christians have supported the American War of Independence in 1776? Now, I trust that seems obvious to you and me, but there's a growing movement in our Reformed circles that says it was not a Christian movement and that Christians should not have supported the American War of Independence in 1776, and they pretty much apologized for it. So I want to give you some ammunition tonight. If you meet up with anybody, and you very likely may, that says that the American, the colonial Christians should not have supported the American War of Independence in 1776, I want to deal with their arguments why they say that, and then I want to try to refute them and give you some ammunition for them. Let me tell you two authors, Reformed authors who are great men, who hold this view. One is a great man named James McGoldrick, who wrote an article called 1776, A Christian Loyalist View. And the other was my friend and one of the greatest historians of the 20th century, Greg Singer, who wrote the otherwise magnificent book, A Theological Interpretation of American History, which both Bill and I recommend to you tremendously, except the chapter on the American War of Independence. So what basically, by the way, Dr. McGoldrick teaches at Greenville Theological Seminary. What are the arguments that these good men give for saying that colonial Christians should not have supported the American War of Independence? Argument one. It was motivated not by Christian biblical arguments, but by John Locke's rationalistic philosophy that sought to de-Christianize political theory with its Enlightenment view of social contract, national law, a natural law, legitimate government is based on the consent of those governed, the sovereignty of the people, and the breaking of a contract by the government legitimizes military resistance against tyranny and revolution. Now, those were the views of men like John Locke. And the argument goes that a revolution in worldview and philosophy prior to the American War of Independence made that war inevitable, much like the Enlightenment made the French Revolution inevitable in 1789. You know, the Enlightenment is when Europe turned away from a Christian moral base and made man the measure of all things. And you know about the European Enlightenment. Once that intellectual revolution took place in Europe, war was inevitable. Whenever there's a philosophical war against a foundation that was once Christian, to remove that foundation and build it upon a humanistic foundation, there's always blood. Always blood. So in 1789, the French Revolution had as its purpose, motivated by people like Voltaire, Robespierre. You know, we all know, we're taught in public schools, that it was caused by these terrible aristocrats, and the peasants who were mistreated rose up to get justice from the aristocrats. There was that there, but that was not the motive of the French Revolution. The motive of the French Revolution was to expunge Christianity from France, to destroy any remnant of Christian moral order and social order in France. That was the purpose. You remember after the revolutionaries won, they had a prostitute through the street and gave her the name Reason. The goddess Reason is a prostitute. You remember what Voltaire said? Voltaire, when he was a great writer, and when he wrote about Jesus, he always referred to him as that scoundrel. And Voltaire was wiser than most Christians in America today, because he said, if we're going to destroy Christianity in France, we must first of all destroy the Christian Sabbath. So that was the mentality behind the French Revolution. Now, what our brothers say is a similar revolution, philosophical revolution in worldview, took place in the United States, in the colonies, prior to the American Revolution, that made the Christian opinion the minority opinion, and that the new consensus before the War of Independence was that of the humanistic enlightenment of Europe and of John Locke and the rest. Argument 2. Romans 13, which says the powers that be are ordained by God, and to resist the powers that be is to resist God. Romans 13's affirmation of the divine establishment of divine ordination as the basis of civil authority denies any right of resistance against tyranny. Now, let me say it again. Romans 13's affirmation that divine authority is the basis of civil government denies any right of resistance against tyranny. And many of them believe that Franklin, Jefferson, and others, in their opinion, being atheists, wanted to create a new civilization in North America based on the dictates of reason, not the Bible. And to acknowledge that dream, a separation from England was necessary. The old political ties with the old world had to be dissolved, and they could only be dissolved by revolution. If they're right, those are strong arguments against a Christian supporting the American Revolution in 1776. Now, let's see if we can refute them. Argument 1, which is the revolution was motivated not by Christian arguments, but by humanistic enlightenment arguments, because a philosophical revolution had taken place in the colonies. We talked this afternoon about the decline of Puritanism. And we talked about the rise of deism and Unitarianism, etc. But the thing to bear in mind that I didn't say this afternoon, because I wanted to save it till this evening, is that although deistic and Unitarian and Lockean ideas were present in the colonies, they did not come to dominate until late in the 18th century, after the Declaration of Independence, after the War of Independence, and after the writing of the United States Constitution. The colonies were already being infected, but these humanistic enlightenment ideas did not come to dominate until after the War for American Independence. Deism and Unitarianism, as we saw this afternoon, were European transplants. And also, American deism, as bad as it was, differed from European deism. Because American deism, though wrong, was infected by some Christian thought. So even though deism began to show up here, it was nowhere near as bad as it was. It was nowhere near as bad as it was in Europe. Now, who do you always hear about as being the worst deists in 1776? Now, remember who the deists were. They didn't believe there was divine authority. They believed there's you live by reason. And that God is the creator that created the world, like creating a watch and then wound it up and stepped out of the picture. So there's no such thing as providence and no need for prayer. Now, who are the two biggest deists that you hear about in 1776? Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. Well, I'm not going to plead for the fact that they were born-again Christians. That's not my point. And I do want to impress you with the fact they were infected with humanism. Understand also that because Christianity was the consensus of opinion, as we will continue to show, even the humanists thought like Christians in many areas, like politics, jurisprudence. Just like today, because humanism is the consensus of opinion, most Christians think like humanists. Well, the reverse was true in 1776, but let me give you a quote from Mr. Franklin and from Mr. Jefferson, and you tell me whether this sounds like pure, unadulterated deism. Okay? Here's Benjamin Franklin at the Constitutional Convention, June the 28th, 1787. In this situation of this assembly, groping as it were in the dark to find the political truth, and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we have not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of Lights to illumine our understandings? Why would a deist pray? In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, he goes on, when we were sensible to danger, we had daily prayers in this room for divine protection. Our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of a superintending providence in our favor. What's a deist doing talking about providence? To that kind providence, we owe this happy opportunity of consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future natural felicity. And have we now forgotten that powerful friend? Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable an empire can rise without his aid? We have been assured, sir, in the sacred writings, that except the Lord built the house, they labor in vain that build it. What's this deist talking about? Prayer, providence, and sacred writings. Do I think Franklin was a born-again Christian? I don't know. But that's not pure deism. Now let me give you a quote from Thomas Jefferson. Can the liberties of a nation be sure when we remove their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with His wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, that His justice cannot sleep forever, that a change of situation is among possible events, that it may become probable by supernatural interference. So you see, even the least Christian of our founding fathers were not pure European deists. Also, when there was a debate as to what would be the national seal or symbol, Benjamin Franklin wanted a wild turkey. Fits him. Thomas Jefferson wanted a two-sided medallion. On one side was Hingster and Horster, the two famous, great famous Anglo-Saxons, showing that American jurisprudence and law goes back to Anglo-Saxon England. But on the other side of the medallion was the pillar of fire leading the children of Israel through the Red Sea. Because he also understood that American law and jurisprudence rooted all the way back in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Now, Jefferson didn't like the redemptive part of the Bible. He didn't like the miraculous part of the Bible. When he wrote his own Bible, removing everything that he didn't like in the Holy Bible, it was just about that big. But the point is that deism did not really dominate things until long after the Constitution, the War of Independence, etc. These Christian and Reformed authors who say the American War of Independence was non-Christian fail to take into consideration or to even mention, in some cases, several crucial facts about the colonies in the mid and late mid 1700s. 1776, says Archie Jones, Christianity reigned as the unquestioned public orthodoxy. And as Rush Dooney said, Franklin and Jefferson do not an enlightenment make. There was nothing in mid, late North America like the European philosophes in Europe. The American context was theological, and the gradual change was not to the Enlightenment, but rather, as we saw this afternoon, from a theocratic Puritanism to a pietistic Puritanism to moralistic Puritanism to Arminianism to humanism. And that humanism did not dominate until the very late 18th century. In 1776, the orientation of most colonists was Christian, although in 1776 the percentage of church membership was very low. Church attendance was high because, as we said this afternoon, the Great Awakening in the 1740s had made church membership unbiblically restrictive. If the American statesmen of 1776 were the founding fathers of our country, then the Pilgrims, English Puritans, Scottish Covenanters, Dutch and German Calvinists, and French Huguenots were the grandfathers. And if they were the grandfathers, John Calvin and John Knox were the great-grandfathers. And although deism may have infected some fashionable intellectual circles in the mid-late 1700s, the consensus of opinion of America before and after the war was essentially Calvinistic and Reformed. Lorraine Bettner says, it is estimated that of the 3 million Americans at the time of the American War of Independence, 100,000 were of Scottish or Scots-Irish origin. 900,000 were of Scottish and Scots-Irish origin. 600,000 were English Puritans. 400,000 were German or Dutch Reformed. In addition, the Episcopalians had their Calvinistic doctrinal statement, the 39 Articles, and this does not count the many French Calvinists or Huguenots that immigrated here. Thus, says Bettner, we see that about two-thirds of the population of the colonies had been trained in the school of Calvin. These people were predominantly Presbyterian as well. Now, let me explain to you what I mean by Presbyterianism. I don't use that word with a capital P. I'm not talking about a denomination. I'm talking about an idea with a small p. That is, all of these Reformed people in North America, the vast majority of them, held the idea of Presbyterianism when it came to church, and then later on applied it to state. Now, what is Presbyterianism with a small p? It's ecclesiastical republicanism. Presbyter is the word from which we get the word elder, and so a Presbyterian church is a church that is an ecclesiastical republic. That is, it's not a democracy. The majority doesn't rule. It's not a human monarchy where one man calls all the shots. It's a representative government that's governed by constitutional law, that is the church, constitutional law, which is the Bible, which constitution is enforced by men, elders, elected democratically by the congregation. That's ecclesiastical republicanism, which was also the model for the United States government in the United States Constitution. That's where they got the idea. At the Constitutional Convention, there was already a republic in this country, and it was Presbyterian churches that believed in representative government. So most of these Many hundreds of thousands of Calvinists were Presbyterians. That is, they believed in ecclesiastical republicanism. I got to say one other thing also, and that is, several years ago we were having a presbytery meeting. For those of you who aren't Presbyterians, that means all the preachers and elders meet to supervise the various churches from which they come. And there was a black man there that we'd never seen before. And so we asked him, we said, "Sir, glad to have you here today, but why are you here? Where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Nicaragua." He said, "I'm from Bluefields, Nicaragua." Bluefields is where this black Indian tribe lives that are native Nicaraguans, but their first language is English and their second language is Spanish. And we said, "Well, welcome from Nicaragua. Why are you here?" He said, "Because I have a little church in Managua, just outside the great capital where the Sandinistas, the Marxists, Leninists, Taoists, under Ortiz, dominate things, having the revolution having taken place. And we've been reading your doctrinal statement, the Westminster Confession of Faith, and we believe it. And we want to come under your care, our little church." I said, "Great." So we started the first Presbyterian church in Managua, Nicaragua. I said, "What are some of the things you like about our doctrinal statement?" He said, "I like your Presbyterianism," small p. I said, "What is it you like about our Presbyterianism? Why do you want to be a Presbyterian church?" He said, "Our church is in the shadow of the Marxist capital, and we want to show the people of Nicaragua what a free republic looks like when you're able to elect your own officials." That's Presbyterianism. And most of the colonists were Presbyterian. You remember what they told the king, George III, what was happening in the colonies. Quote, "The colonies had run off with a Presbyterian parson." Who was the Presbyterian parson? John Witherspoon, the only preacher to sign the Declaration of Independence. And what did they call the War of Independence in Great Britain? The Presbyterian Rebellion. Ahlstrom said, if one were to can't read my writing. So, I'll have to paraphrase here. He said, if one, I put this in Southern. He said, if one were to consider all of the Reformed people and all the Presbyterians in the colonies in 1776, the Swiss, the German, the Dutch, the Scottish, the Scotch-Irish, and all the rest, he said, whose forebearers bore the stamp of Geneva, in some broader sense, 85 to 90% of the colonists being Calvinists would not be an extravagant estimate. He said in a book called A Religious History of the American People. Of course, this is not to say that our War of Independence was a totally Reformed or Christian endeavor. Several phrases and ideas used and secularized by John Locke in the Enlightenment in the late 17th century, were used by Calvin and the Reformers in the mid-16th century. So we didn't get their ideas from them. They got their ideas from us and secularized them. Here's some of Calvin's things that you can hear in a sort of secularized version in Locke and the various other humanists. Calvin said, rulers were to obey and enforce all of the Ten Commandments. Now, you don't hear that much in Locke. Calvin said, citizens have the normal duty to obey their rulers, but they have a higher allegiance to Christ, and they are to disregard the rulers' tyrannical orders that require disobeying God. Furthermore, Calvin taught in the Institutes, subordinate lesser magistrates have not only the right, but the duty to oppose and resist the intemperance of kings according to the obligation of their office. And they may even be accused of perjury by reason of any deception whereby treacherously they betray the liberty of the people, of which they ought to recognize themselves as divinely ordained ministers by the will of God. I have some other quotes here from Calvin. It talks about using the military force if necessary against tyrants. Calvin says this in his commentary on Hosea 5:11 and Daniel 6:22. When the king perverted God's worship, when he set up corrupt superstitions, then the people ought to have firmly resisted him. The two commands, fear God and honor the king, Calvin said in 1 Peter 2:17, are connected together and cannot be separated from one another. Fear of God ought to precede that kings may obtain their authority. For if anyone begins his reverence of an earthly prince by rejecting that of God, he will act preposterously, since this is a complete perversion of the order of nature. Then let God be feared in the first place, and earthly princes will obtain their authority, if only God shines forth. Daniel therefore here defends himself with justice, since he had not committed any crime against the king. For he was compelled to obey the command of God, and he neglected what the king had ordered in opposition to it. For earthly princes lay aside all their power when they rise up against God, and are unworthy of being reckoned among the number of mankind. Hope our politicians are listening. We ought rather utterly to defy than to obey them. Now, let me say what it says literally in Calvin's Institutes concerning these tyrannical rulers. This is literally Calvin. We ought rather to spit on their heads than to obey them whenever they are so restive and wish to spoil God of his rights, and as it were to seize upon his throne and draw him down from heaven. So here you have a Calvinist long before Locke talking about the duty of the resistance of tyranny. Or to summarize, in the words of Archie Jones, though the people as such have no right to overthrow the rule of one whom they consider a tyrant, a degree of temperance and more important conformity to the Bible is inserted by obliging the people to follow the lead of the lesser magistrates who have been appointed to curb the tyranny of kings and who are also ordained by God. In other words, the old Calvinistic principle of all of these countries that came here with their Presbyterianism and their Calvinism is that the people just can't get up and have a revolution if they don't like the king or if he's a tyrant. That they must be led by a lesser magistrate that's ordained by God. And then that lesser magistrate can lead the people to resist against a tyrant. Or here's the doctrine. Here's the doctrinal statement of most of the people in the colonies in 1776. It's found in the Westminster Confession of Faith, written in 1643. This is chapter 23. Paragraph 2 and 4. I'm showing you now that these ideas originated in Calvinism, not in the Enlightenment. Confession of Faith. It is lawful for Christians to accept and execute the office of a magistrate when called thereunto, in the managing whereof, as they ought especially to maintain piety, justice, and peace according to the wholesome laws of each commonwealth. So for that end, they may lawfully now, under the New Testament, wage war upon just and necessary occasions. You see, the commitment is to wholesome laws. Or paragraph 4, it is the duty of the people to obey the lawful commands of the civil magistrates. These reformed critics of the Christian basis of America, of Americans' War of Independence, misinterpret and misapply Romans 13, which says, in essence, the powers that be are ordained of God, and to resist the powers that be are to resist God himself. They think that chapter is descriptive rather than prescriptive for citizens and magistrates. Let me read that again. It's very important. They make the mistake of thinking that Romans 13 is descriptive rather than prescriptive for citizens and for magistrates. That is, they say in essence that Romans 13 is not commanding anything of the magistrates or of the citizens. It's just describing the situation. Whatever the civil government, it's ordained of God. Rome, Caesar, whoever it is simply describing the situation without any kind of ethical implications for it. I have a great and simple little quote here by Greg Bahnsen. And if I can find it, I will read it to you. Let's see here. Now, this is a mistake that many people make in this culture, too. Seven, here it is. Bahnsen said this. Paul's words in Romans 13 have definite bearing on what governments ought to be and do, and on what citizens ought to be and do. And his words can hardly be construed as offering unqualified acceptance of every specific human ruler, like Hitler, Stalin, Mao Zedong, etc. In other words, as Romans 13 requires of citizens submission to the just and wholesome laws of the civil magistrate, so Romans 13 requires of civil magistrate submission to the supremacy of Almighty God. So these critics of the American Revolution fail to really interpret Romans 13 adequately. It's not simply describing something. It's not simply saying no matter who the government is, you must submit to it. You may not resist it. You may not defy it. You may obey it no matter what. Caesar, Hitler, Stalin, whoever. Whereas, rather than that, it is prescribing what citizens and civil magistrates should do. Go home and read it this evening. Citizens should be in submission to the wholesome laws of the civil magistrate, and the civil magistrate but must be in submission to the law of God. These critics fail to emphasize the higher allegiance we have to Jesus Christ, who according to the Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 20, paragraph 2, who alone is the Lord of the conscience, and has left it free from the doctrines and commandments of men, which are in anything contrary to his word, or beside it, in matters of faith and worship. So that to believe such doctrines, or to obey such commands out of conscience, is to betray true liberty of conscience. They also fail to emphasize that the colonial armies were not a collection of vigilantes acting as a mob. That's what I talk to a lot of people today, and they think that they say, hey, these British are mean, let's all get together and go shoot them. The colonial armies were not a collection of vigilantes acting as a mob, but were legal armies called to arms by legal colonial governments to carry out their God-appointed role, as Romans 13 says, of protecting their citizens from law-breaking people who would seek to destroy them. Law was on the side of the colonies, who interposed in defense of their citizens. The King and Parliament of England were the lawbreakers. Unlike the French Revolution that aimed at the breakdown of law and Christianity, The American War of Independence was a war of self-defense against a tyrant, and therefore aimed at establishing law and establishing Christianity. The king was breaking the law by not keeping his covenants with his colonies. And the parliament was breaking the law by usurping despotic rule over the sovereign 13 nations of America who had their own legislatures and with whom parliament legally had nothing to do. The colonies were doing what Calvin taught them to do. Follow lesser magistrates in the resistance of tyranny. These reformed critics of the American War of Independence do not even mention the greater impact of John Knox, Samuel Rutherford, Lex Rex, the French Huguenot book Vindicii Contra Tyrannis on the colonies in 1776, than Locke and the Enlightenment. Remember that at least half, or maybe even most, colonists then spoke with a Scottish accent. John Knox, even more than John Calvin, was the great theological emphasis on the colonies in 1776. And among his distinctive contributions to the Protestant Reformation are these two things. One is a covenantal view of politics. Knox is famous for these two things. People in the colonies love Knox. One, he said that there are four covenants that are the basis of a free and just civil magistrate. And he got all four from the Bible. The first is a covenant the civil magistrate makes with God that he will rule in submission to his supremacy. The second covenant was the covenant that the civil magistrate made with the people that he would protect them in terms of the law of God. The third covenant was the covenant the people made with the civil magistrate that they would be loyal to the civil magistrate as long as he kept his covenants with God. Therein hangs a tale. And the fourth covenant was the covenant the people made with God that they would be his faithful and loyal people above all else. That's called federal politics. You ever wonder why we call our government in Washington the federal government? Because of John Knox. You know what the word federal comes from? It comes from a Latin word for covenant. Now the only remnant we have of Knoxian politics is when the president puts his hand on the Bible. That's about it. But that's what people believe, this Knoxian covenantal view of politics in the colonies. And these critics of our war don't even mention John Knox. But there's another contribution that John Knox made, and that is his teaching on the legitimacy of the resistance against tyrants. That's why he opposed Mary, Queen of Scots. That got him in a lot of trouble. That he believed it was the civil magistrate's responsibility to overthrow tyrants in places of high authority. Duty. It was their duty. And it was the duty of the people to follow the lesser magistrates in the overthrowing of tyrannical and idolatrous kings and queens. Then there was Samuel Rutherford. Samuel Rutherford was a Scottish preacher in the mid-1600s. But in 1776, his book was one of the bestsellers in the colonies. Now, when our history books talk about bestsellers, who do they always mention? Thomas Paine, Common Sense, an atheist. And modern historians love him because he was an atheist. And the colonists quoted him. The colonists quoted anybody that had a phrase that they thought they could fit into their system to convince Europe that they were fighting for freedom and independence. And the mistake the colonists made, in hindsight, is that they thought in quoting all of these Europeans, speaking in the language of the Europeans to convince them that our cause was just, they thought that they could take phrases from these various people like Thomas Paine
and strip them of their philosophical context. In hindsight, they probably shouldn't have done that. But there were two other bestsellers in the colonies in 1776 beside Thomas Paine. One was Samuel Rutherford's book, Lex Rex, and the other was Vindicii Contra Tyrannis, written by a French Huguenot, and the translation is A Vindication of Liberty Against Tyranny. Now, why is it most modern historians don't ever mention Lex Rex and Vindicii? There's one reason. They all mention Thomas Paine. They're not about to admit the two other bestsellers in 1776 were these books because they are Calvinistic. Staunchly Calvinistic. And modern historians do not want to let you to know that the consensus of opinion in the colonies was Calvinistic. I'll never forget reading a book review. Now, I wasn't alive at the time when Charles Darwin wrote his book, The Origin of the Species. But I did read a book review from some magazine on The Origin of the Species right after it came out. And this describes the attitude of modern Americans toward Calvin. They said concerning Darwin's book, "At last, finally, we have an alternative to the God of Calvin." Now, why would anybody not love the God of Calvin? I love the God of Calvin with all my heart. And I look forward to seeing him someday. Not Calvin, but the God of Calvin. I expect to see Calvin too. Because the God of Calvin is the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, why would anybody not want to worship and serve that God? Because you can't manipulate a sovereign God. You can't escape him. And so here are two Calvinistic books that were bestsellers. The first is Samuel Rutherford, Scottish Presbyterian preacher, middle 1600s. Lex Rex means the law is king. It was written during a day in which the monarch of England were Stuarts, and they believed in an absolute rule of the kings, and they believed Rex Lex. They believe the king is law, and the source of law is the king. So Samuel Rutherford writes the book Lex Rex. It was so offensive to the throne of England that they had all the first edition destroyed, or at least they thought they did. I've seen one. I've held one in my hand. I mean, that's 20,000 years off purgatory. I've held one in my hand. If you can find one, it'll cost you an arm and a leg. Now, why did the kings of England hate Samuel Rutherford's book Lex Rex? And why was it a bestseller in the colonies 100 years later? Several reasons. One of the reasons is because Samuel Rutherford said in his book that if God's going to bless England and Scotland, the people have to be allowed to elect their kings. The Stuarts didn't take kindly to that. But he didn't just stop there. There's a comma after that, kings. He said, if God's going to bless Scotland and England, we must be free to elect our kings as Israel elected her kings in the Old Testament. Now, that offends Christians today because most Christians have no idea that the people of Israel in the Old Testament elected their kings. Read the Bible and see if that's not true. But the point is, you can see why the colonists loved the book, while the British didn't. And then there's another reason the colonists loved it and the kings didn't. And that is because Samuel Rutherford said, now remember, he's an ecclesiastical Republican and also a political Republican. And he says in this book, the people are above the king. The power of the people is greater than that of the king. Uh-oh. Did he all of a sudden become a Democrat? No. When he defines people, just like our Constitution, it doesn't mean the aggregate group of individuals. It means the representatives of the people. The representatives of the people have a higher authority than the king.
we, the people of the United States, represented in those representing us in government. And then there's another reason the colonists loved them. And bear in mind, this is a bestseller. This is a consensus of opinion. There was nothing radical or extreme about Samuel Rutherford, as far as the colonies were concerned. And he says this. He says, only God can distinguish good from evil, and he's done so in the Bible. Now remember, what was the Stuart's absolutism? The will of the king is the source of law. He said, only God can distinguish good from evil, and he's done so in the Bible. Leave it up to man, and man will call good evil and evil good. I'm sure we all are followers of Samuel Rutherford on the first one. Second, only God can define what crime is, and he's done so in the Bible. Leave it up to man to define crime, and he'll punish good people and call them evil. Only God can define what crime is, what a criminal act is, and he's done so in the Bible. Makes sense to me. Third, only God can define how crime is to be punished justly, and he's done so in the Bible. Only God can define how crime is to be punished justly, and he's done so in the Bible. You can see why the Stuarts hated Rutherford and why the colonists love him. By the way, if you believe those three principles from Rutherford, that only God can distinguish good from evil, and he's done so in the Bible. Only God can define what a criminal act is, and he's done so in the Bible. And only God can define how crime is to be punished justly, and he's done so in the Bible. You will be a teeny little minority of people in this country. And if your friends find out you believe that, they will get mad at you. I love the story of his death. They sent a troop of soldiers to his house and summoned him to court to be tried as a traitor and be burned at the stake. And so the soldiers come into his room where he's on his deathbed, and they say to him, Samuel Rutherford, His Majesty is summoning you to court to be tried for treason. Samuel Rutherford said, Give His Majesty my regrets. I'm being summoned to a higher court than his own. And he soon died. Then there's another book that was a bestseller, and that's by a Frenchman named Duplessis Mornay, Vindicii Contra Tyrannis. And that was written in 1579. And listen to the main points of this book as paraphrased by Rush Dooney. Any ruler who commands anything contrary to the law of God thereby forfeits his realm. Rebellion is refusal to obey God, for we ought to obey God rather than man. Vindicii Contra Tyrannis. To obey the ruler when he commands what is against God's law is true rebellion. Since God's law is the fundamental law and the only true source of law, and neither king nor subject is exempt from it, war is sometimes required in order to defend God's law against the king. Legal rebellion required the leadership of lesser magistrates. Those in the name of the law, the royal disillusion or contempt of the law. All these doctrines were basic to the colonial cause. So how in the world can our brothers say that the War of American Independence was not motivated and stimulated by Christian causes and Christian reasons? It was motivated and informed by the previous several hundred years of Protestant Reform theology and politics and religion. Hence, the American War of Independence was a just war that all Christians then should have supported, and we do not need to apologize for it. The American War of Independence was based on principles entirely contrary to those of the Enlightenment and the French Revolution of 1789. As Peter Drucker said in his book, The Future of Industrial Man, far from being a revolt against the old tyranny of feudalism, the American Revolution was a conservative counter-revolution in the name of freedom against the new tyranny of the rationalist, of liberalism, and of enlightened despotism. The freedom of man, the freedom that they experienced in the 19th and 18th century up to this day has been based upon the Christian ideas, principles, institutions of the American conservative counter-revolution of 1776. And insofar as we turn from those principles and institutions of freedom in this country in the 21st century, we turn toward greater tyranny. And insofar as we refuse to resist the tyranny that continues to grow in our culture, to that extent we move into greater apostasy and deeper tyranny. As Robert Dabney said in his famous lecture, The New South, given in 1882, comparing the American culture built on the Christian and Reformed principles of our founding fathers with the new America of the 20th and 21st century created by anti-Christian humanism, he said, this century has seen all this reversed, and conditions of human society have grown up which make the system of our free forefathers obviously impractical in the future. And this is so, not because the old forms were not good enough for this day, but because they were too good for it.